Welcome to Listen In. I'm Brian Gahan, and this podcast focuses on the stories that are buried deep inside all conversations. Be it the kind of conversation you have with someone whose life experience is full of interesting POVs and insights, or the kind of conversation you have inside your own head around your own life experiences. Today, in episode 10, I'm talking with naturopathic doctor, scientific researcher, and author, Alan C. Logan. Alan talks about the increasing negative effects of ultra-processed foods on our life's true potential, the exciting new scientific evidence on the microbiome and gut health, and how teaching food justice to youth is the best way to get them to become advocates for their own health and wellness. Hey, Alan, welcome to Listen In.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks very much for the honor of being able to spend some time with you.
Well, I'm so glad that you've given us your time. I've always wanted to sit down and talk with you and kind of get into the details around what I call modern day holistic nutrition. But before we go into all the amazing things that are happening now, let's go back a bit and let's talk about your personal journey on how you ended up becoming someone who's dedicated your life to the research and education on nutrition, but also a little bit, you know, we can touch on sort of some of the things that have happened in society and culture that have kind of brought us to this point where we're at today. So take me back to a young Alan Logan and what drove you down this road into this, the sort of study of nutrition.
Well, it's a great question, and without turning this into a Tolstoy novel, my own interest was in general holistic healthcare, if you will, mind-body medicine, exercise, connection to nature in particular. That's always been something that's driven me, my interest in the influence of natural environments and health. So having a look at naturopathic medicine as an educational path was of interest to me. And then going through school in Toronto, I really gravitated towards nutrition. And at the time, you know, other dietetics programs, if you will, and thankfully there's been great change in that, so we can talk about those cultural shifts. But at the time, dietetic programs were largely driven by content that was really squared off and a bit rigid. With regard to messages that were largely driven by large agricultural groups and so forth, the likes of messaging that soft drinks were part of a balanced diet and what have you. So it was one of the reasons why I actually chose to go down the pathway I did. And then what happens is you sort of see those around you that you observe, that you work with, including medical doctors. And you see the success that they have with nutrition as part of a lifestyle approach, which is now under the moniker of lifestyle medicine, is a larger umbrella, which captures a lot of the things I just mentioned, including exercise, you know, mind-body medicine, mindfulness, and connection to nature. Because even nutrition itself, you can run the risk of pigeonholing it in one degree because, you know, in order to try to create change, knowledge about what healthy dietary patterns are one thing, but it's also has to do with all the other factors that would lead someone to lead a healthy life lifestyle and be able to adhere to healthy dietary guidelines. That's why things like stress and so forth come into it. So that was my backdrop. My interest was observing others, but then also really trying to focus in, well, where's the research at? Because sadly, and this continues to this day, the nutrition field is plagued by opinions. Mm-hmm. And again, the same rigid level of thinking that went on 20 years ago, there are still plenty of aspects of that as well. So I tried to go towards where the research is, Brian.
Yeah, okay. So that's a great place for us to jump in. So you're talking about the research side. So if I had to break down what I heard you just describe, you know, you were a lover of sort of natural environments and nature and how that impacted our lives. At the time that you probably started your journey, there was a little bit of woo-woo or whatever you want to say around the natural sort of holistic lifestyle. And so you and your nature was to go into the science of it to try and understand and prove that there was something behind this. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. I think that, you know, we have to progress, you know, through research, through science or investigation. That's not to say that, you know, individual reports and case reports and, you know, wonderful feedback is unimportant. It's vitally important because it drives scientific query. But, you know, and we can get to this, Brian, and, you know, we're living in this sort of so-called post-truth world that we're in at the moment. So I don't think there's ever been a more important time that we try to focus in on, you know, at least evidence-informed practices. So that was always something that I was very interested in. And, you know, once you've queried something enough and it's just not passing muster, then I think you kind of have to move on to other things, you know. And I've always gravitated toward it. And that it's not just nutrition. It applies to the other areas that I am interested in as well. You know, again, whether it's exercise or other aspects of lifestyle. Again, just emphasizing just one more time that all of these things are interconnected. Because if you were going to ask someone to consume more plant-based fruits and vegetables and healthy dietary patterns, again, you know, that for many North Americans is actually a tough ask. It sounds easy on paper, but then you have to consider all the other things that are related to quote unquote compliance with what many North Americans find difficult.
Right. So you say to somebody, hey, make sure you eat more fruits and vegetables, and then they spend 2 hours in a commute in their car, live in a stressful urban environment, and all that they have around them is processed and fast food.
You got it. And that is what, so basically what that well-intended person is fighting a monstrous amount of marketing and messaging and convenience. And as you said, Brian, then you layer in, they've had a long day, they're tired, they're fatigued, convenience is going to trump, you know, other thoughts quite often. And so the default mechanism of westernization is actually ultra-processed foods and beverages by convenience. And that is the issue here at hand as well.
Mm-hmm. And so take me back a bit in history to how we got to ultra-processed foods. Like, how did that become the norm?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's been, it was a relatively slow and steady process. You know, if you look at Canadians' consumption of highly processed foods, there's been dramatic increases in recent decades. So, of course, and it's not to say that processing is can be a great thing. I mean, to a point. When we talk about highly and ultra-processed foods, we're stripping away all of the important nutritional aspects, fiber, essential fats, phytonutrients, these colorful components that give plants taste, texture, as I said, their color, of course, their aromas and so on. These are being stripped away through ultra-processing. And to get back to your question, Brian, it happened, as I said, slowly, but then around 1970, with advances in food technology and preservation, you ended up having an absolute untold amount of change in the nutritional landscape vis-a-vis convenience packaged foods. And in order to do that, you know, again, my mantra is, if you're doing one thing, you're not doing another. And what happens is, when you strip away all these important nutrients, you're leaving the very square components that I mentioned earlier behind. So you're leaving X amount of fat, X amount of carbohydrate, X amount of protein, but you've removed fiber, essential fats, phytonutrients, and others, which we can discuss. And the problem is, if you're relying on those foods through convenience, you're also adding in other players, emulsifiers, and other food additives that we're now starting to learn may be a lot more detrimental than we once thought. So it's a matter of food processing advances, some of which have served us well, but generally speaking, it has become very problematic for non-communicable diseases.
Right. So we have this, you know, epidemic almost in our food supply, where we're seeing all sorts of processing happening. I mean, even the terms, you know, highly processed and ultra processed. I mean, we seem to have a definition for the different stages of processing.
Yes.
So we have that happening. And then we have a bunch of other aspects that are happening in our sort of day-to-day lives when it comes to other types of things like over-sanitization. Maybe you can talk a little bit about those.
Yeah, so, you know, the way that we deal, and this actually takes us back to the study of natural environments as well. You know, we were out, we were making contact, growing our own food quite often, and making contact with microbes of all sorts through our food supply, our lifestyle habits, in ways that we're not today. But if you think about how we would have been through our evolutionary past until today, it's extremely different in what we put into our mouths, but also the way that we handle those foods. We're consuming less fermented foods. Our relationship with microbes has changed dramatically. And there's lots of research that shows this. When you start to see animal studies where they withdraw fiber, when they withdraw those phytonutrients, technically called phytochemicals, again, just to reemphasize, these are the natural chemicals that exist in plant foods that give plants their color, their aromas, their taste, their texture. When you remove those, as you would do with highly and ultra-processed foods, you're actually altering your microbes. And microbes, of course, are another part of nature. They coexist with us. For every human cell, there's one microbial cell. If you're walking down Yonge Street, heading in to the bay, shopping in Holt Renfrew, whatever it is that you do, you're doing that with microbes. You and your microbes together are a multi-species entity. And I bring that up because it is related to all of the biological functioning that goes on in the human body. So as you said, our relationship has changed, and you can extend it. You mentioned sanitization practices, you know, and of course, there's important public health messaging in there. It's important to wash your hands, you know, sneeze into the elbow and what have you. No one's disputing that. But we also run the risk of over-sanitizing. Antibacterial, antimicrobial products in general, certainly antibiotic prescriptions, about a third of them are unnecessary. And they've entered the food supply, and all of that serves to alter our relationship with nature. It's not just about green space. It's also about the nature, as I said, means microbes too.
Right.
So there's a lot of layers to this.
Yeah, there's a couple of great quotes I want to get into in a bit around that, but you're reminding me of a personal story when my daughter was about 8 months old. We were out in Tofino, and for people who don't know where that is, that's on the west coast of Vancouver Island, and it's, you know, Long Beach, and it's got sand and ocean, and it's quite beautiful. So we're there playing on the sand, and there's those, you know, low tide pools that have left water in the sand as a bit of a pool. And there's all sorts of stuff in there. It's baking in the hot summer sun. And I look over and my daughter has a mouth full of the sand, like just like dripping down her chin. She has just scooped a mouth of this sand that's just got to be full of everything that's wonderful in the ocean. And I remember the time looking at her and thinking, okay, that's probably a good thing. And lo and behold, fast forward, she's now 12, and she's never been a kid who gets sick or that sick. And I always go back to that moment of, as a parent, thinking, oh my God, what's happening to my poor child? She shouldn't be putting that sand in her mouth. And I thought, well, maybe she should. Maybe that was a good thing.
Yeah, but it's an amazing anecdote, a beautiful story, actually, because there's so many wonderful aspects to that, as you as a parent out in nature, and it's likely to be the case. There's certainly lots of research now coming out on early life contact with nature, incidental contact with microbes being important as part of human health and vitality later in life. So I think that's a wonderful story. We could spend so much of our time just talking about things like soil microbes. For example, there's a bunch of research coming out right now on something called M. vaccae, Mycobacterium vaccae. It's found in soils throughout the world, particularly damp soils. And there is a wonderful array of research ongoing right now indicating the health benefits. Most of them are animal studies. There's been several human studies, but mostly animal studies indicating the long-term value, including stress resiliency, when animals are exposed to this relatively innocuous soil microbe. I mean, it's quite remarkable. Mm-hmm. And that's just one. I mean, imagine that's a single soil microbe.
Right. Well, I mean, and that was the quote that I was alluding to earlier, where it was talking about biodiversity and the fact that the, and I'm going to get this wrong, but something to do with the larger the number of the plant species in a environment, the greater sustainability or natural sustainability that exists. So the more of something, the better.
Yeah.
And we've spent, or what I'm hearing us do is I'm seeing us in our food stripping out the more. I see us in our daily environments through sanitation stripping out the more. And then, you know, through the use of antibiotics and other types of things, we're stripping out the more on the inside of our bodies when it comes to our gut bacteria and that sort of thing and our microbiome.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You're hitting the nail on the head. And, you know, again, this is also connected, you know, to our foundational part of our conversation, which is nutrition, because, again, when you take away the more, you strip the foods, the fiber, just fiber alone, let alone the other things that you're taking out. Even if you only looked at the fiber, researchers have actually shown that there's transgenerational effects of that. If you keep removing fiber across several generations of animals, you actually flatten the diversity of the microbes. So you're losing things. We don't even know what we might be losing. And if you actually compare westernized adults with more isolated hunter-gatherer communities, they have far and away more microbial diversity than we do. But remarkably, a significant portion of the microbes that they harbor, we don't even know what they are. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's a startling thing. It's like a black box of potential threatening loss. Right. So you're actually, this conversation sort of takes us around greater discussions of losses. And I mean, with microbes, it's right up on the edge of what you might call extinction conversations. But certainly loss of diversity, as you mentioned, is dramatic. I mean, look, when you think about those ultra processed food numbers and what they represent in North America, ultra processed foods, which again is doing nothing for microbial diversity. It's removing the opportunity, the potential for microbial diversity. You're talking about 50% of our total energy intake from those. Mm-hmm. And there's two problems with that. You're including emulsifiers and high sugar and all the other detrimental things that are carried with those foods. And at the same time, you're displacing the foods that actually would work for you. So in a way, it's either it's for you or it's against you. And that's the issue. What are you taking in that can have potentially detrimental effects? And what are you not having that would have potentially protective effects? So displacement is a central part of the conversation.
And shouldn't this be criminal? I mean, taking a food supply and stripping it and putting things in that are causing harm. Like, why is this allowed?
That's really a great question, and that's close to my heart. There's been several academic articles that have written about this, including using the words criminality, particularly with what some academic groups consider to be highly offensive, is the ways in which multinational corporations who were in the business of spreading ultra-processed foods, dominating the fast food landscape, pushing high sugar beverages, especially into disadvantaged communities, that they're, when they align with not-for-profit, that at first glance, it's superficially, these not-for-profits look great. It all looks wonderful because there's virtue signaling that goes on. Recently, a major global fast food chain, you may be aware of this, has decided to create a box with a fast food hamburger, fries, and a soft drink to raise awareness of mental health. Now, if there's anything in my mind that's more disturbing than that, you're talking about the very thing, because if you look at all your body of research in nutritional psychiatry, which clearly shows that healthy dietary habits are in the, you know, the interest of promoting mental health. And when you actually package up and box something that's the antithesis of that, and that you then attach a virtue signaling, hey, we're for the promotion of mental health. And that's why a lot of academics are now questioning the alliances that are made between major multinationals that push these types of foods and you know, not-for-profits that are generally well-intended. So this is the problem, you see. So you have so-called greenwashing and, you know, discussions of environmentally sustainable products and so forth. We know that goes on all the time, but the same thing happens in the nutrition industry, you know, and it takes us back to the conversation about soft drinks. At one point, these nutritional bulletins were put out by major dietetic organizations saying they were called nutrition fact sheets, and they were stating that soft drinks are part of a balanced diet. Mm-hmm. It's obscene. So yes, it is a problem.
Welcome back. I'm talking with naturopathic doctor, researcher, and author Alan C. Logan, who's sharing the disturbing story of Astrofoods in the 70s, the new connection between nutrition and mental health, and what's now on the line for our youth.
Incredible story, Brian, of a breakfast product in the United States that's called Astrofood. It was called Astrofood. And it's actually a wonderful parable, because you asked earlier about, like, when did this real transition happen? Mm-hmm. Where all of a sudden we got to a place where in a relatively short period of time, half or more of our energy intake is from ultra-processed foods. This particular story, and I'll keep it relatively brief, but the Astrofood story involves politics. It involves jumping through loopholes that basically determine what constitutes breakfast. And the long and the short of it is Twinkies, the actual company, Continental Bakery at the time, they came up with the bright idea. They saw a loophole in the children's breakfast program, and they knew that if they added soy protein isolate to Twinkies, that they could actually get a product that meets the breakfast criteria for school children in the United States. So this was literally Twinkies with added soy protein isolate, more emulsifiers, more sugar, okay? And, you know, you talk about a quote. they said, we achieve what nature could not do. And they put those cakes into schools, particularly in disadvantaged communities throughout North America. These are children that didn't have options for breakfast. Mm-hmm. And they claimed in the marketing of these Astrofood cakes. So what they did was they renamed the Twinkies Astrofood. And they said it was the equivalent of 4 ounces of orange juice, 2 strips of bacon, an egg, and a piece of buttered toast. Meanwhile, they were essentially massive, you know, cellophane wrapped boluses of sugar, vegetable oil, soy protein isolate, as we mentioned, and emulsifiers. And that got trucked to schools, as I mentioned, mostly disadvantaged communities. So this is what goes on. It's really representative of really something that's so corrupt and needs to be fixed, because everything is on the line here for children. Mm-hmm. Especially as we now learn so much about the research coming out in the area of what's called nutritional psychiatry. which is essentially looking at the way in which nutrition influences mental health, both in the disorders aspect of that term, but also on the broader scheme, things like vitality and the way and mental energy and so forth.
Right. So we've talked about mental health a number of times. So let's dive into that conversation around nutrition, proper nutrition and mental health. And because we're seeing mental health right now just becoming a conversation that is not being so stigmatized, at least in North America, it's starting to become something that people are willing to talk about. How far are we from the place where we're okay to talk about the fact that it could be something that's being caused by nutrition?
I think we're really getting much closer to that. What we needed before, and you see, this is what takes us full circle to your query on, you know, why I was interested in more on the science, more on, you know, approaching this entire topic from an evidence-informed perspective. Because even though we probably knew instinctually that there's a connection between what we put into our body and the brain-related consequences to that, there wasn't a lot of research in the realm. So we were just essentially going, there was loads, you know, and when I say there wasn't, I'm talking about the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s.
Right.
And during that period of time, there was growing research in the area of cardiovascular disease, for example, and nutrition. So it no longer, you know, it was just accepted, yes, there's strong connections between how we eat and our heart health, let's say. And then diabetes, of course, and other things. But mental health was like the last big, you know, fortress that it was never penetrated with evidence and science until recently. So if you look at the last decade, there's been a massive growth. And it's great because you brought up the notion that stigma is starting to decline, and I'm so delighted to see that. And you're right, there's definitely evidence of that. Still a long way to go, but you're starting to see, you know, breaking down of those barriers. And it's coincident and it's in concert with a massive rise in research, animal studies, epidemiological studies, or large population studies, clinical interventions, in the realm of nutrition and mental health. And you're now starting to see it evolve to the point where you're seeing individuals with major depressive disorder going through a healthy eating intervention versus other sort of talk therapy and so on with solid, clinically relevant benefits in depression by changing the way that the individual eats. Dr. Felice Jacka, who's an Australian scientist, is the lead in this, and her organization, which is the International Society for Nutritional Psychiatry Research, has just grown leaps and bounds. They have their major conference coming up in the autumn 2019. And there's major players at all of the major universities are now realizing this is a critical area of research. So although there was only small amounts going back 10 or 20 years ago, there's little doubt at this point what's on the line. So that's why I was saying, and you brought up the term, you know, with the criminology aspect of this, when you realize what's on the line with young children, teenagers, and how it is that your mental health in your youth determines so much of your potential life course. Well, we've got a lot on the line here.
Right. So let's say, you know, the research comes in and it starts to prove that the increase in mental health issues is not just we're now becoming aware of it. So therefore, we're noticing it more, that it's actually on the rise. There are more people suffering from mental illness. The science proves that it is part of our nutrition. But meanwhile, we've stripped away everything, messed with our food supply, you know, GMO'd things, you know, pesticided things. We've done so much to the thing that's, like, how do you turn this around?
I think it is turning around. I think there's a lot of room for optimism here. I think it was a matter of penetrating a more global awareness, especially in academia. I think it's so important where you have to get the conversation going with trusted authorities and institutions that society still maintains a significant amount of trust in. And that's starting to happen now. And generally speaking, this is not rocket science. This is about trying, if you look at the available research, as I mentioned, whether it's animal studies, and there are many, so they start to see these associations between two things: the westernized diet having a detrimental effect on areas of the brain, including the limbic system that are involved in emotion. And then on the other side, important things, those very things we talked about, stripping out fiber, essential fats, including omega-3 fatty acids in particular, phytochemicals or phytonutrients, again, that are important components of these healthy foods. So you're seeing those being connected to beneficial effects in the animal brain in all volumes of international research in animals. Then you add to that the epidemiological or population studies that show clearly over time. So it's not just a matter of, okay, who's eating what at a given time. That'll only get you so far. But when you have large cohorts and you follow them over time and you took a baseline of who was eating what type of foods, and then you follow them for extended periods of time, 10 years even, and you find massive differences in the number of people who ultimately go on to have major depressive disorder, for example, who had been eating a westernized dietary habit. And then you add in the small but growing number of intervention studies. It all adds up to a strength in argument. Now what you're doing is you're saying, look, it's not that complicated in terms of knowing what to eat. Right. Mm-hmm. So that part of it is, it's actually really modeling this off the Mediterranean diet, really. You know, so that aspect of it is not complicated. What's more complicated is taking us back once again to where you and I started off. And that's the interconnected difficulties in maintaining or, you know, that exemplified Mediterranean diet and what it represents. Adhering to it is the more difficult part. So we're starting to get the science in place about the argument's strong now, but now it's how do we get people there? So right. That's the challenge.
And that's the part where, you know, and I don't want to be the pessimist here, but, you know, I live a fairly healthy diet and lifestyle to the best of my ability, but I'm finding it harder and harder to maintain that. You know, even this past winter in the grocery store, I noticed the lack of produce. There just seemed to not be as much. And I found myself, you know, turning to processed foods a little more often than I normally would have, just out of a need to, you know, to feed my family. So, you know, so that brings in the concept of is there, you know, can the average person living in an urban environment survive at the grocery store, or is there a need for supplementation in some way, shape, or form?
Supplementation plays an important role. There's no question it can be very helpful. There's lots of research in that realm too. But if you're not having a core healthy diet, then I think the expectations of supplementing decline rapidly. The further you are away from that, let's just again use that model of the Mediterranean diet. The further you are away from it and the closer you are to ultra-processed foods as dominating your dietary habits, I think it's a tall order to expect supplementation to be able to undo that. That said, you can still include many things. The problem with supplementation is if it's very isolated, if you're just trying to take one thing, expect one particular ingredient to be this magic bullet for you, well, the evidence so far has been pretty clear. There are no single nutritional magic bullets. There are exceptions to that, of course. If someone has a genetic issue going on where certain single nutrients may be vital for them. But you really, if with supplementation, I think it's really important to include a variety of plant foods, if possible, in those approaches. So yes, you're right. I mean, just backing up for a minute though to what you described, it's difficult, but it's certainly not impossible. I think it's important that we start layering in messages to realize how people are being, for lack of a better term, hoodwinked into eating ultra processed foods and drinking unhealthy beverages by default. And one of the ways you do that with young people is to educate them about nutrition in a different way. So you start to talk about this as matters of power and inequality and food justice. See, that's when young people, and research shows this, there's several recent studies that have shown this. If you teach youth, right, so teenagers, about healthy dietary habits from a nutritional textbook, their eyes glaze over. They're not that interested in the links between healthy nutrition and their risk of cardiovascular disease decades later, or even really mental health for that matter. However, when you see these studies and they're actually taught that, wait a minute, you're actually being played by marketing messages. And or if you engage them, there's studies in Los Angeles, for example, in South Los Angeles, where they actually take a active role in transforming an urban corner store. And that's when you see change take place. You has to be framed in a matter of inequality and food justice and power, because quite frankly, that's what it is. That's what it is. And that takes us back to the story of the Astro food, the Twinkie dressed up as breakfast. And when people start to see that, and it certainly the research shows it in teenagers, but I would argue that everyone, if they start to understand those connections, no one likes to be played.
Right. I love that term, nutritional justice.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, that's what this is. That's what this is. Because when you think about it, and it's a rhetorical question, but do you think it's just that in South Los Angeles, which is a 32 square mile area, okay, it has 45% of the fast food outlets of the entire 500 square mile city of Los Angeles? I don't consider that to be just.
Mm-hmm.
I don't consider, because you know what? When you go into affluent Bel Air, Los Angeles, you're not seeing 45% of the fast food outlets there.
Right.
So there are many layers, or just our Astro foods, which are Twinkies. If I go into Detroit right now, I go into disadvantaged communities, I know I'm going to see Twinkies in convenience stores and all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And yet, the person who bought out the Twinkies, just to show you, we have to talk about these power dynamics. All this stuff is intertwined. It's easy to talk about the Mediterranean diet, but the nuances which create the way we eat. The owner of Twinkies that bought out the company has recently purchased a Playboy mansion in Los Angeles. So you see how things are, right?
Yeah.
You get to see how these systems work. And the Twinkies put you into the Playboy mansion. These are matters of justice and power and inequality. And Twinkies are only a surrogate marker. That's all. And I think that's how we need to start creating this. So there's several avenues of approach. Now that we've got academic experts, trusted individuals who are now saying, wait a minute, healthy nutrition matters to mental health and vitality. Now we know. That's why I feel so optimistic about this. If you didn't have trusted institutions saying this, and if it was only, in the back conversation of a small health food store, well, then it would be difficult. But that is changing fast, and I am very optimistic about that. Notwithstanding, as you said, Brian, there's a lot of barriers, a lot of them, but it's awareness and recognition.
Right, and so there's this huge movement that's trying to educate people around the importance of food. And when we talk about food, we mean whole foods that's full of all the phytonutrients, all the phytochemicals, has all the right microbes and this sort of thing in it. So we're desperately trying to educate people on that. And then we'll have the large food processing companies add, you know, omega-3s to orange juice. Mm-hmm. And tell everybody just drink our orange juice because you're getting omega-3s. I mean, you know, it wasn't that long ago where we just saw omega-3s being added to almost every processed food group out there. What's going to stop us from just, you know, having these large food companies just sort of, sugarcoat, for lack of a better term, you know, nutrition? Or are we going to wake up and realize that we need to have a holistic approach to nutrition?
I think the latter is going to happen. And I think there's been some societal shifts that have indicated that that is going to happen. For example, the new Canada Food Guide is all about plant foods, including as many of the veggies that you can get in. We're now past the time we need to be telling people they need 5 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables. At this point, we just need to get that message out there that we need more. And it was actually, a turning point in the trajectory, an inflection, if you will, when we were no longer have a Canada Food Guide that's dominated by the talking points of certain segments, sectors of the agricultural industry. And when you have a predominantly plant-based message, a whole foods message, I think that is a sign of optimism. There's a place for adding back in things. I don't mind it so much if it's orange juice. I mind it if it's in, as you said, and you mentioned this, putting them back into ultra-processed foods, because that's not the answer. And you're right, and that happens all the time. And I think that people were starting to get woke about that and realize it. We have miles to travel still, miles to travel. But I do think that there is starting to become some level of awareness that putting in some B vitamins and some omega-3 into an ultra-processed cake, as in the Astro Food story, is not tenable. It's right. Not tenable. It's not undoing dysbiosis in the gut, which, of course, from its Latin roots, Greek roots, means life in distress, right? We tend to think about dysbiosis about being shifts in their microbiome, loss of diversity, for example, loss of beneficial bacteria, encroachment by potentially harmful bacteria. But actually, it means something larger than that. It means life in distress. And when individuals are consuming foods that are smokescreened with a couple of milligrams of omega-3 inside of an Astro Food cake, and again, we're using that as a surrogate marker for
right.
all of the 50% of our energy that we get from ultra-processed foods, then if you think about the mental health connection, then life really will be in distress. So the person is actually living with dysbiosis at the large scale, dysbiosis in the gut, dysbiosis at the holistic person level, and then you can actually expand that to the larger community level.
Right.
And that's exactly what happens, Brian. That's why I mentioned about stuffing 45% of the fast food outlets into, you know, the small area of South Los Angeles.
Welcome back. I'm talking with naturopathic doctor, researcher, and author Alan C. Logan, who is going deep into the microbiome and the new science which is illuminating the interconnectivity of all aspects of life on planet Earth.
So that's a nice segue into the revolution that we're seeing right now around the education around the microbiome, right? So talk about that. Talk about the microbiome.
Sure. Well, I think that it is a good segue because the microbiome to me is, and there's almost an irony to it because these are unseen microbes, bacteria, fungi, viruses, and other microorganisms that live on and within us. They're unseen, but yet the science the advanced technology, which is illuminating the activities of these microorganisms, is actually allowing us to see the interconnectivity of all aspects of life on planet Earth. And it actually lets us see the interconnectivity of the way that our social and political and economic systems influence and manifest themselves right into the gut level. Because somewhere, there is a group of individuals, powerful individuals, that are creating the ordinances that allow for 45% of the fast food outlets to be stuffed in a small area in South Los Angeles and excluded from the affluent Bel Air, okay? So you start to see then the presence of those fast food outlets. And just hang with me for a minute, because I'm going to take you right to how this is a microbiome story. Because the presence of fast food outlets, the associated marketing, the convenience of it, influences the way that we eat. It then influences the person at the biological level. It influences the person at their microbiome level. And the research that supports this is actually out of Chicago, which showed that disadvantaged communities, right, with low income, different dietary habits, they indeed have loss of beneficial bacteria in the gut, less diversity. So these things are manifesting themselves right down into the gastrointestinal tract, which in turn influences so many aspects of metabolism, overall health, and even potentially mental health. So what you're seeing then, given the fact that each one of us, as I said, you're one part microbial on a cell-to-cell basis. So think about high school biology class and putting a tiny piece of skin or any other tissue or plant tissue underneath the microscope, and you see those little cells there, right? And each one of those cells has a microbial equivalent on a cell-to-cell basis as you walk down the street. And they are not just sitting there doing nothing. These are very active organisms. And in particular, they have genetic material that they carry with them that far and away outnumbers us on a genetic basis. If you're going to talk about genes, human genes versus the microbial genes that you walk up and down the street with, you're about 95% microbial at the genetic level. And that matters because these microbial genes are functional. They do things. They actually influence so many aspects of metabolism, physiology, and so forth. So there's when you start to see the science evolving here that shows the relationships between what you eat, your stress levels, you already mentioned your interactions with nature, for example, and then how it influences the microbes, which in turn influence so many aspects of human health, metabolism, and physiology in general, then all of these connections from how it is that we allow ultra-processed foods to be marketed, especially to disadvantaged people, because I keep saying that because this is where it comes to power and justice. It's a matter of social justice. And the microbiome, which influences so many aspects of health, we can now draw a straight line between the two.
So is there a chance, you know, could you get to the point, like, say, we got with tobacco, where there's enough scientific evidence and proof that the microbiome is crucial to a healthy human being, that anybody who does or provides something that harms it would be deemed criminal? Like, can you see that happening in our lifetime?
We need to travel a significant distance in science and research to get to that point. For now, we can only say, generally speaking, that a diverse set of microbes is in the interest of health and wellness. That's a very broad and general and safe statement to make. And that is in line with all ecosystems. If you go out into the greater world of natural environments, you already mentioned it yourself, Brian, diversity is associated with the health of any ecosystem. But to take it out to, you know, what we need to do to connect where we're at the moment to this potential place that could be envisioned, where you're actually really, in a criminal way, disturbing, you know, the ecosystem, if you will, because it influences so many aspects of health. In order to get to that point, which could be decades away, we first need to understand more about what constitutes a healthy microbiome first. We only are tap dancing around that at the moment. We know enough to know that we're disturbing it in many ways through dietary practices, through overuse of antibiotics, and so forth. But we have first in our immediate priority is to try to determine which among these untold amount of microbes, which families, which species, which strains can help to curb the epidemic of chronic non-communicable diseases. But there is certainly on the horizon, you know, research that shows, draws those connections and those parallels. And what I think in the more immediate term, what it'll help to do is illuminate and galvanize people for change, taking us back to our story about the young people who, when they're presented information in the context of power and justice and economics, then they start to say, wait a minute, this isn't right. Mm-hmm. This isn't right. And that's what's going to create the change, I think.
Yeah, and that's something that I look forward to seeing happen, because it just seems that, you know, as you say, we live in a post-truth era.
Yes.
And so a lot of the truth gets, you know, switched, whitewashed, whatever you want to call it, into being some other form or message. And then, you know, they'll go full circle back to just blaming it on the individual and saying, well, every human has their choice to eat what they want to eat, and they need to take responsibility for their diet, which of course they do. But as you say, if every street corner only has fast food restaurants on it in your neighborhood, it's kind of hard to make a salad. And I think that that's the thing that we're seeing happening in a lot of parts of North America, is that you're seeing small grassroots organizations bring just like the growing of vegetables into urban neighborhoods and things like that. And
yes,
you know, in Toronto, there's this organization that does shipping containers, and they turn them into little kind of grocery farmer markets in low income neighborhoods and allow people to buy fresh produce and things like that at a reasonable price. You know, it seems insane that we're having to do that. But,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I agree. But again, these grassroots movements, this is what affects change. And, you know, I think quite often the health food industry doesn't get enough credit for having been agents of change. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about even the nutrition meets mental health connections, these were discussed. And now here we have all of this evidence. So again, I go with an evidence-informed approach, but I also have tremendous respect for the pioneers that, because the thing is that people are suffering in the here and now, right?
Right.
And if someone was helping and guiding someone who had depression, let's say, by trying to help them to eat healthier, even though there wasn't volumes of research at the time, that person was almost certainly helped. So, you know, it's very easy, I think, sometimes in the post-truth world, I you know, you have to deal with so much misinformation that's out there. But at the same time, I think it's easy to forget that there were many pioneers that were trying to help people, you know, with the best available knowledge that they had. And as strong as I believe that we need to, our only hope really of progressing forward and emerging from this misinformation mess that we're in is through evidence, is through information, appropriate information, proper education and so forth, and shifting the way that we look at things. Sometimes it's just, as we've been mentioning, I think it's been a theme throughout our conversation, it's just a matter of switching the lens in which we see things. But at the same time, I think we also have to maintain, when I say we, I mean just in the larger scheme of things, levels of respect and appreciation for those who really were pioneers in the area, especially of nutrition and mental health.
Yeah, and that goes back to our mutual friend, Stuart Brown from Genuine Health. I had him and Joy McCarthy on another episode where we were talking about, you know, how Greens Plus came to be and how Sam had created it to help disadvantaged youth who were suffering from, you know, mental stress issues and behavior issues. And he had deduced that it was from a lack of proper nutrition. And so that's an example of a pioneer who, you know, what was that? Almost 30 years ago.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So now you're going back 30 years in a case like that. And that's a great, you know, bookend to the conversation about doling out Astrofood cakes with, you know, some soy protein isolate, some sugar and emulsifiers, because it met the criteria. So it was very insightful for Sam Gracie to see those connections. Others were doing the same thing, you know, again, looking at if you improved certain aspects of nutrition, then health and behavior improved. You know, some of the early research studies in the realm of nutrition and, you know, I mean, it's called nutritional psychiatry. It's a term that I don't particularly like because it pigeonholes it into the profession of psychiatry. I don't think that we need something like that. I'm in complete awe of the scientists who are in that realm. They're heroes in society. They're brilliant. It's just a nomenclature, because what it does is it further pigeonholes something. Like, we don't need exercise psychiatry and, you know, natural environment psychiatry. So I just feel like that's part of the shift that we need to do too. We need to take these things away from these really reductionist approaches, and it almost creates a sort of sense of turf. But if you go back in time, some of the original research studies, and even though I had said to you earlier, Brian, that it's a tall order to expect, you know, certain nutrients or supplements to undo things, in fairness, a lot of the research that we've gotten to today with regard to whole food nutrition and mental health and so forth, the early indications were actually from simple studies, including giving omega-3 fatty acids and a B vitamin complex, for example, to individuals who were incarcerated. And compared to placebo, they had less infractions and so forth, and, you know, violent behavior. So you started, those were the early studies that started to put the links between, you know, certain aspects of nutrition and behavior.
Yeah.
So that's sort of where it emerged from.
Yeah, and I like the term you brought up back at the beginning of this conversation around lifestyle medicine.
Yeah.
You know, I think that that's a great, easy to understand way of putting it. You know, it's about looking at your lifestyle and treating it from a medical kind of POV, as opposed to, you know, because I always joke about this when I'm talking to different people about, you know, some people just love to just pigeonhole people and say, well, they're, you know, they're into peace, love, and granola, or they're into healthy stuff, or they're Zen, and that's just the way they are. And yeah, that, as opposed to, well, I'm not that way. I'm a type A caffeine drinking, you know, pizza chomping person. And so, you know, that's just the way I am, as opposed to, no, it's about lifestyle and it's the medicine of that. And it's, how do you fix it? How do you improve your lifestyle? How do you get outside more? How do you eat better? And I think that if we approach it from that POV, it seems more holistic.
I agree with you. I think it's a term I think that's going to stick. There's many, many physicians now. Look, again, 80% of mortality is connected to lifestyle variables, modifiable lifestyle variables, of which nutrition is a central component. So with that understanding, and as we transition, you know, towards dealing with non-communicable diseases, everything from cardiovascular disease and onward, including mental disorders, that's the epidemic. Some call it a pandemic globally that we're dealing with. So given its connection to lifestyle. And really importantly, the one little asterisk that sits with that is the understanding, and you said it yourself, the individual takes responsibility, but it's also with the awareness that that involves regulatory action. And it's far and away too easy at the moment for individuals to be manipulated into consuming unhealthy foods and beverages. And that's the part that needs to change, because the lifestyle, it conjures up an image that the individual is solely responsible for it. And I think as a collective, given what's on the line, particularly for our children, our youth, as they develop, knowing how it is that these nutritional and other lifestyle factors influence their health 10, 20, 30 years from now, their ability to reach their potential in life. So collectively as a society, I think we need to appreciate that lifestyle as it pertains to reaching your potential in this, on this planet.
Yeah, like that's something that we don't, you know, I thought, you know, death by lifestyle, right? Like, in other words, you could see it on somebody's tombstone. Like, what killed them? Lifestyle.
Yes, you know? But that's the truth.
Yeah. That's actually the truth. Well, if it's 80%, that's a pretty big cause. But in the nature of education and helping people learn more, how can people find out more about you, Alan? Is there a website they can go to? Are you on social media? Are there books that you've written that people should read? Just maybe take a few seconds and give yourself a bit of a plug.
Yeah, I'm not very good at giving myself a plug, to be honest. I have co-authored several books, a couple of which are relevant to our conversation. The most recent one was in 2017, published by New Society. It's called The Secret Life of Your Microbiome. And it really approaches this topic, connecting our way of life and our microbiome and all aspects of human life on the planet. It's heavily dedicated towards natural environments, our loss of biodiversity globally, which is a pressing issue. And also, I've written and co-authored a book called Your Brain on Nature, which again connects many aspects of what we discussed, including nutritional. But again, it's dominated by conversations on our relationship to nature, green space, and so forth. So the website is yourbrainonnature.com. Find a little bit more about me over there. And I'm not a massive social media guy because I'm too busy turning over stones looking at the latest studies on natural environments. So I leave that to others who can do it effectively. But as I said, the website's there if you want to learn more about me.
Yeah, and I loved your book, Your Brain on Nature. I mean, I just there were aspects of it that some of the studies of just, you know, 20 minutes outside walking through a park and the difference it can make to people's mental functioning. I thought that's a must read, I think, for everybody who lives in an urban environment.
Well, I really appreciate that, Brian. Thanks a million.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your time, Alan. It's been a real pleasure diving deep into all of this with you. And I wish you much success in making this more available to more people so we can get to that point where we do make a systemic change in our society. Thank you.
Thanks a million.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, that's another episode of Listen In. Thanks for being. Please subscribe, leave comments, or head on over to our website at listeninpod.com. That's listen with two N's, pod.com, where you'll find episode notes, links to anything that we talked about in this episode, and you can connect with us about being a guest on Listen In.